Okay, today is, what is today? February 25th, 2020. We are here inside Union South. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. I'm here interviewing Kim Lord Plummer. And Kim, and this is for our Academic Staff Award winners oral history project. So Kim, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
My name is Kim Lord Plummer, and my last name is spelled LORDPLUMMER.
Okay. Looks like I didn't do my due diligence here, Kim. It's not turned up high enough, but it'll be once. All right. Oh yeah, that's much better. Okay. So, Kim, I sent you a list of questions in advance. I'm just going to take them one by one. As I
Sure.
said, the caveat is I may do some follow-ups depending on what I hear
Sure.
in your answers. So, first question is a big broad one. You know, what brought you to UW-Madison?
That's a very good question. So I've been here since 1983 on campus, so quite a long time. And I came here as a graduate student, actually. So I did my undergraduate degree at McGill University in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. I'm Canadian. And while I was there, I was working in a laboratory on campus that studied demyelinating diseases in various species, particularly canine species. And I, through that work, met a fellow named Ian Duncan, who was coming down to the University of Wisconsin-Madison to start his career. And so he was looking to populate his lab and get graduate students, and I sat down, met with him, and one thing led to another, and I ended up coming to his lab to do a master's degree from 83 to 85 in looking at various aspects of myelination in the central nervous system. So I followed Ian Duncan down here and did a master's for a couple of years, and then decided that I really did enjoy research, and that was the area that I would like to pursue. So I entered the neurosciences training program on campus, which is nationally known, world-renowned training program for the neurosciences here. One of the very first in the country, actually. And so got into another lab, Mary Bean, at the School of Veterinary Medicine. Ian was also at the School of Veterinary Medicine, so both labs were in that building. And did a PhD with her for several years. And that's how I arrived on campus and stayed for several years doing research in a couple of different labs. Got a PhD in neuroscience, and then went off to the medical school area of campus to pursue continued postgraduate research, postdoctoral research. But in the interim of doing that, a lot of life happened. So, as it happened, my husband at the then, he's still my husband, but as far as his life goes, then he got offered a job here in Madison that was the dream job. And so I had intended to leave campus and pursue research in other laboratories in the country. But we were also working on starting a family at the time, and just a lot of things like that sort of kept me in the Madison area. And so because I was doing postdoctoral work in the med school, I met a bunch of people there who taught in the med school, and they were looking for someone to help out with histology and other courses there. So I said, I love teaching, so I'll help out. And so that's how I got into teaching, actually, was at the med school while I was doing postdoctoral research. And first time I'd ever taught, I'd done a lot of teaching beforehand as a TA and in various other capacities over many years. That was the first time I'd taught in a professional school. And I just fell head over heels in love with teaching at this university, and working with professional students. So that's kind of a synopsis of that sort of or those early, let's say, 10 to 12 years here on campus.
Just because we don't know who will listen to this and in what context, you mentioned the word your interest in myelination.
Yes.
Could you explain a little bit about what that is?
Sure. So, in the nervous system, both the central nervous system, brain and spinal cord, and the peripheral nervous system, all our nerves that make our body work and collect all the sensory information from the environment, All of those nerves, or many of those nerves, have a fatty insulation surrounding the axons, and it's called myelin. And without myelin, your nerves don't work, basically. So it speeds up electrical conduction to the extent that if we weren't able to have that speed of electrical conduction in the central nervous system, in the peripheral nervous system, we wouldn't function. So it's an essential part of neural physiology.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about what brought you here, sort of what factors were there. So maybe just to back up even to the undergrad at McGill, what got you interested in what you became interested in?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I'd probably have to go back to a little bit before undergrad. So in the province of Quebec in Canada, and this isn't true of all of Canada, but in Quebec, our educational system is a little bit different. So we go 11 years of high school, and then we do what's called a CEGEP program, which is an acronym for a French educational system. I won't go through that now, but you do 2 years of CEGEP, and then that prepares you for college. So it's a little bit of a kind of a tracking system, actually. So out of high school, you can do this 2-year CEGEP program, and it can be a terminal program, much like a vocational program, or you can use it as your entrance into a university, you know, full university program. And so people do both, and I chose to take a science track and got all the prerequisites in order to go to McGill University. So while I was doing that CEGEP program, I met a woman, most interesting woman, and I can't think of her name off the top of my head now because this is going back 40 years, but a wonderful woman who was the first female scientist I'd ever really come across and had a chance to get to know personally. And she was just, you know, you've heard this story before. She was one of these really encouraging people who saw in me some potential to do science and be curious and learn new things about the world and all of those things that are, you know, essential qualities in someone pursuing a career in science. And so she suggested, I took a course of hers, and she suggested that I do an independent project. And so I did, and I still remember it to this day. I won't go into the details of it, but just working with her, it was very encouraging, and it kind of was an epiphany to me that this is something that I could do, and I found it interesting, and you know, and so that's really how I got interested in science, and then scientific research per se. I was always interested in science. For whatever reason, you know, as a young kid, I was the one going out and collecting the frogs and the insects, and you know, I always had an interest in physics and anything scientific, you know, that was interesting about the natural world. I found interesting, so that was sort of inherent, I think, just to my general personality. But it was meeting this woman who made me realize that, oh, okay, that's something that I could actually do, because I would have never thought of it. I'm first generation college student, university student. You know, my parents grew up in World War II, and so, you know, there was really no expectation to go to college, university, to pursue anything beyond high school education, you know, secondary education. So it was just that fortuitous really meeting with this woman who kind of inspired me to think beyond my small town in southern Quebec and, you know, yeah. So that was how I got into that.
What were your parents, what were their vocations?
So my mother was a stay-at-home mother, and my father was project manager, I guess, for a company called American Built Right. I'm not sure it still exists, but it is an American company, and they made a lot of machinery of various sorts, I think, and then had several outposts in Canada. So he was an office worker in that in that company for some time. Yeah.
So you said you were a first generation college student. Did your parents? I guess, how did your parents feel about college for their children?
You know, we just never ever talked about it, honestly. My father was a very quiet man, as were many people of his generation. So he was a bomber pilot, actually, in World War II. Flew many missions over Germany, and, you know, that... As a result of that, and partly his personality too, he just was kind of a quiet man and kept to himself, never mentioned college. My mother, on the other hand, was actually very well self-educated. She never went to college, but she read voraciously. She was very interested in science too, just reading about the history of science. That was one of her passions. So she read a lot of historical fiction, but also a lot of historical nonfiction. And part of that was just, you know, stories about scientific discoveries and that kind of thing. So she was always interested in that. So she was very well-spoken, well-educated in that sense, mm-hmm. but not formally. But, you know, we had a college, a small liberal arts college in our town, so they weren't unaware of sort of people going to college and getting, you know, advanced degrees and that kind of thing. But it was just never really came up. Also, the other thing is that both of my parents ended up with fairly devastating diseases, and both died quite when I was quite young. So my father died when I was, 18. No, sorry. My mother died when I was 18. My father died when I was 20. So they didn't actually even live to see, mm-hmm. you know, me go on and go to college and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for that. Mm-hmm. We went backwards a little bit. We're now going to come forward again, but okay. That's sometimes how these things go. So, instead of asking sort of to describe what you do, I want to take a moment here and so you talked about teaching. You first taught in the med school, mm-hmm. and you loved it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're now teaching in vet med.
That's right. Veterinary medical program. Yeah.
Again, sort of a broad question, but maybe you can sketch us how you get from this first love of teaching,
sure.
to where you are now,
sure.
in terms,
sure.
of the classes that you teach and how you got there.
Sure. So while I was in the med school, as I kind of alluded to a little bit earlier, my husband and I started a family, and he got a job that just kind of kept us really in this area. And it was a wonderful job. It was a great opportunity for him. And given that we were starting a family and, you know, all these different sort of factors came together, that I decided to actually step back from research and spend more time teaching. And as it happened, and this was probably around 96 or something like that, 97, I ran into the chairman of one of our basic science departments at the School of Veterinary Medicine, Gordon Mitchell, and he said, you know, Kim, we're looking for someone to do a lot of teaching in the first year curriculum. And so that was kind of how it all started. And Gordon Mitchell, I'd known for years because, as I mentioned, I did my master's and PhD at the vet school. So I knew a lot of the folks there, and I knew Gordon very, very well as a colleague in research. Then stepped away from the vet school, went to the med school, and was there for several years. And then that's when I ran into Gordon. And he mentioned that they were looking for someone to teach in the anatomy courses. And so I thought about it and talked it over with my husband, and you know, it was a bit of a decision because it meant really, really at that point stepping away from research and committing to teaching. And given that I had done a fair bit of teaching in various capacities up to that point, knew I really, really loved it, I decided to make the leap. So I was hired then there, I think it was about 97 now. Which doesn't seem like long ago, but I guess it was a long time ago. it's 2020. Wow.
Yeah.
So anyway, just kind of started out slow, actually, as a part-time employee, because I was raising my children at the time, and that was really important to me. That's one way I identify very strongly, actually, as a mother. And given that, you know, my parents died early, I really wanted to be very present and involved in my children's young life, at least. I was part-time teaching in the small animal anatomy course there. So I had taught anatomy in the med school and in other places, so I was very familiar with fundamental principles of anatomy, and it was just a matter of getting up to speed on the very specific variations on a theme in our veterinary species. So studied hard that subject for a couple of years until I felt, you know, very, very comfortable with teaching. And so I've been teaching the small animal anatomy course for over 20 years now. Okay. And then just slowly kind of worked into the large animal anatomy course, which I also teach. And then also, because I had done my PhD with Mary Behan at the vet school, she was the course director of our neuroscience course there in first year. And so knowing her very well, I had taught off and on in that course as an interim, you know, director, as a TA in various capacities. And when she left the course to take a different position in the vet school, I took over leadership of that course as well. And that, of course, is right in my wheelhouse because I have a degree in neuroscience. So, So I was really thrilled to be able to teach the veterinary neuroanatomy and neurophysiology course. So those are the three courses that I sort of worked into over time. Okay. And I guess in about 2007, I became the full-time director, course director for the neuroscience course and for the large animal anatomy course. I was interim director for the small animal anatomy course for a couple of years while there was a transition in leadership of that course. So I really had sort of three major courses that I was developing, sort of trying to move forward, update, modify to fit our newer, savvier digital learners. And so it was quite a load for a long period of time.
Right.
Yeah.
While you're having a sip of your coffee there, there's a couple of things that stand out to me. You talked about that you took over the small animal anatomy course and you had to sort of bring yourself up to speed.
Well, when I first joined the course, I didn't take it over. I was just a member of teaching team.
But you still needed to.
Yes, I did. Yes.
So it's not. I know it's not the same as science research, but it seems to me that you were having to do research anyway to become familiar. So you were still doing research. It was just to become familiar enough to be able to teach a course.
Yeah, I guess in a sense, more study I think than research. Mm-hmm. You know, just pulling, you know, canine cadavers out of the cooler and just poring over them for, you know, as many hours as it took to really, really understand the anatomy deeply. Deeply enough to extract fundamental principles. So one of the things that's very important to me in terms of my teaching philosophy is big picture. I think it's so important to understand the big picture, to understand general principles. You can look up details, you can memorize details, you can do whatever you want with details, but if you don't have a context within which to apply the details, then the details are just meaningless bits of information. So I took it very seriously from the point of view that I wanted to just really deconstruct this dog so I understood every last speck of it, so I could back up and say, okay, what's really important? What do the students really need to know in order to become, you know, self-motivated learners, in order to be able to take what they learn from this canine model and apply it to every other species except humans. So veterinarians, of course, are responsible for the health and well-being of every species except humans. And honestly, you could add humans to that as well because of one medicine. But so we can't possibly teach them the variations on a theme of every species. So we have to teach them how to figure out how to learn about every species, and we use the canine model as a way to approach that kind of learning. So to me, that was the most interesting part of teaching anatomy to the students, was really trying to figure out what are the hooks, where are the places where they can get excited and they can go, okay, well, I can take this principle to a rabbit or to a lizard or to a snake, and I can apply it and then learn myself.
Thank you. The second thing, and you alluded to this, but I think it would be nice to, if somebody listens to this, to have it spelled out. So you talk about becoming the full-time course director. What does that really mean for these courses that you are teach?
Sure. So in the vet school, basically the course director or course coordinator, you could call it, we tend to use the term course director, is just you kind of oversee kind of the day in and day out of management of the course. So for example, with something like an anatomy course, you're going to have to start working months in advance to make sure you've got all the materials you need for the students to use for their learning. So cadavers, for example. So acquiring cadavers, whether that means purchasing them or what I did for many years for the large animal course is I actually prepared my own cadaver specimens. So, and that's a kind of a long and complicated story. I don't need to necessarily go into that, but you know, we would get animals and prepare them for, you know, through euthanasia and prepare them through fixation as specimens for learning anatomy. So that was something I did for a long time. That was one aspect of, you know, sort of managing and being part of a team and the anatomy courses. And then everything from, you know, writing exams to developing lectures, developing new topics that maybe we've had ideas about for years but just haven't had a chance to do it, completely, you know, reworking notes, learning the digital side of everything, so learning how to use Canvas, Canvas, before that, D2L, and I don't even know what there was before that, but so learning all these management systems and how they can best be deployed for teaching. What else do I do? There's a lot of small tasks, big tasks, all that kind of thing. Training other people too, actually. So as the years have gone by, I've kind of been the sort of steady one there for a very long time. So I was fortunate enough to have mentors back in the 80s and early 90s. I mentioned one of them, Mary Behan, another person I taught anatomy with, who actually created the anatomy course for the vet school, Dr. Norm Wilsman. I consider them some of the most wonderful, effective, giving, supportive mentors that I've ever had. I've kind of got off track.
You're talking about course director.
Right. So basically, I learned how to manage a course, teach a course, oversee a team from those two people, from Mary Behan and Norm Wilsman. There's all that, the sort of the big picture stuff, but as I say, you know, it's all the day-to-day, you know, giving lectures, helping others. Oh, I know what I was saying about training other people. So, you know, they provided me with the training that I needed, which was instrumental in me to move forward in teaching. And so I've tried to give that back to all the new folks that we've hired over the years. So that's been a big part of my job.
Okay.
Mentoring students, I mean, that's a huge part of it. Not only teaching them, but professional students come into the program and they're really quite young at that point. You know, they're just out of undergrad, and for some of them, they've come from different parts of the country or different parts of the world to pursue a degree in veterinary medicine, and some of them just need a little bit of help along the way. So myself and other instructors in the first year program have always kind of served as sort of the mothers and people that, you know, these students can you know, knock on their door and just say, can I sit down and chat for a while? You know, I'm not sure if this is where I should be, or I don't understand what I need to be doing right now. And, you know, just guiding them as best we can.
Right.
So that's a part of it, too. So it's kind of all over the map. It's a sort of a jack of all trades, in addition to just the sort of standard lecturing, teaching, lab teaching, and all that kind of thing. Yeah,
and that sort of hit the typical day question. You alluded to technology, actually mentioned a couple of things, and one of the questions is how have changes in technology changed your work? I wonder if you might provide some other examples.
Sure. So I would say that there's so many good things about technology. I mean, my generation, of course, I took typing classes when I was in high school, so, you know, it's, yeah. I would say that technology has helped my job for sure. It's made me aware of different ways that we can connect people, both in terms of how to educate them and, you know, sort of outreach, so, you know, gaining access to the public, teaching them about what we do here at the university. So I think those parts of technology are really good. I'm still kind of old-fashioned. You know, when I first started teaching in the med school, I was writing on a blackboard, you know, and I was sort of talking in real time with the students and jotting things on the blackboard and drawing pictures. I was thinking about that the other night, actually. And I miss a little bit of that because it just slowed down teaching. You know, you were sort of, they were with you, step lock, you know, just working together as opposed to the way we do it now or often do it now with PowerPoints and all that kind of thing. So there's that side of it. I feel like sometimes I just want to slow it down, get rid of all the technology, and just really have that conversation, that interaction with students, which we do in the laboratory. So that's part of the reason I love laboratory teaching, because there's really no technology. It's you, the students, and a dog, or a horse, or an ox. but so there's that aspect of it. And I understand that technology allows us to, you know, tap into a lot of different ways of learning. So I think that's really, really valuable. But I do, just speaking for myself alone, I do miss that kind of easier, quieter, slower way of teaching and reaching students. The other part of this is the learning management systems. So it started with D2L, which was pretty stripped down, pretty basic. And now, of course, as you know, we have Canvas. I feel like that has added a huge amount to my workload, to be perfectly honest. At first, D2L, yeah, it's really cool. We can have this stuff posted for students. We can access it remotely. That's great. You know, if there's a situation where there's a pandemic, you know, we've got everything's lecture captured now. Pandemic, students can listen to lectures, you know, through the medical school archives, lecture capture archives. They can go to D2L and they can access notes. You know, that seems like a really great advance to have, you know, to allow students who might not be able to be mobile for whatever reason to access all this, all the materials for learning. So that's a great thing, and it still is a great thing, I think. However, with the advent of Canvas now, it seems like that's all I do, honestly, on a weekly basis. I may spend several hours in a week just loading stuff on Canvas, making it, putting it in a form that it is, that it'll work on Canvas. So the more we put on Canvas, the more at least our students want. So we provide them with, you know, the class notes, the lecture notes, the, you know, whatever else is accompanies that particular lecture, let's say. And then they tell us, well, you know, that's not enough, now we need this. And I see you use this in your lecture, why can't we get that image? You know, and it just sort of snowballs. And so part of that is because it's easy to put that stuff in a place where students can access it. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. So for me, again, I think having the ability for people to access educational materials remotely, if they're not mobile, is a great thing. I really do think that's a great thing. But the other side of it is all the work that goes into creating that stuff.
Right.
That goes into that system. People don't really think about that side of it. Yep. So now I've done a whole bunch of video tutorials for students in the neuroscience course. You know, because the learners these days really do like to do that kind of remote learning. They like to listen to lecture capture. They like to watch videos. And I can see that being very powerful because then they go into class and they've already had some of that information up front. But so the short answer is it has created a tremendous amount of work behind the scenes.
Right.
Yeah. So
I need to take a quick peek at the. Okay, we got a few minutes. I do have a 9:15. And as I said, I think I said in the email, I reserve the right to maybe see if you might do a follow up over the phone just to make sure we get all
sure,
these questions.
Sure. Yeah.
So what I think I want to end with. today, depending on how the answer goes, is one of the things I like to ask academic staff is, do you ever think about the relationship between staff and faculty?
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, what are your thoughts on on your thoughts on that?
I definitely do. And so I would say that my interactions with faculty have been wholly very positive over the years. As I mentioned, two faculty in particular, Mary Bean, who was my PhD advisor, and Dr. Norm Wilsman, who is really my mentor in all things, not only research but also teaching. I really credit them with who I am today. I mean, and actually in my little speech last year for this award, they were the two people that, that I talked about more than anybody else in thanking them because, as I say, everything I think that I am, you know, fundamentally in terms of teaching, really comes from them, and I'm always channeling them. I giggle to myself at times that I'm always channeling them when I'm teaching. So my interactions with the faculty in the vet school and the faculty on campus have always been positive. You know, I think a lot of academic staff, depending on where they've come from and, you know, where their sort of career path has taken them, there are times when you think on a campus like this, it really is geared toward, you know, research money. If you are a PI, you run a research lab, you are the person bringing the money in, and, you know, you pursue that tenure track position. You do what you need to do to achieve tenure, and that's kind of the model of many of these, you know, sort of high-level research universities, and that's a great thing. I think sometimes, though, it leaves academic staff who really do have a lot of high-level training as well feeling like it's hard to... I'm not exactly sure how to put it, but it's hard to sometimes get the respect maybe that you feel you've earned over years or decades of doing the research, developing pedagogy, advancing education and courses and methods of teaching on this campus. You know, as I say, I think I've been lucky that I've had really wonderful faculty to work with over the years. But I think the new HR system is something that's made that change a little bit. So if I go back 10 years and I think about the interactions I had with my faculty colleagues, I really felt like they were colleagues. Mm-hmm. We really worked together in a very much almost equal team setting, knowing that, of course, I was academic staff, soft money, they were faculty, tenured, always realizing there's that system, that hierarchy. But I always felt like I was really working with colleagues, and it was productive, and it was wonderful, and it was, encouraging, and I always felt really, really good about my position and my job. I think with the HR design change, and now the total compensation, TTC, all of that, it sort of pulls, I think, faculty and staff, at least in my opinion, mm-hmm. further apart from each other. Mm-hmm. You know, so it really establishes, kind of reestablishes in a very explicit way that hierarchy. And so a person that I worked with, one of our faculty that I worked with for years, really as a colleague, and, you know, I'd been teaching much longer than this person is now my supervisor. Mm-hmm. And so, and I know that's happening all over campus, where you've got academic staff who've been here for 30 years, who are really experts in their field, and now someone who's 20 years their junior who doesn't have the same experience has become their mm-hmm. supervisor. And I think there's a little, you know, there are some not so positive feelings, right, let's say, about that. Mm-hmm. So I would say that that's really just very recent, though, in the last maybe, you know, few years, okay, since we've had this really redesign of the human resources sort of model on campus. Mm-hmm. But I think I can summarize by saying that I have been very lucky in my department with the chair people of the department, which is comparative biosciences in the vet school. The faculty I've worked with have just been absolutely tremendous. And I remain very, very good friends with those. They're all retired now, but I remain very good friends with all of those people because we really did work together as colleagues. And I don't know that the newer faculty that I work with now, I would say the same about. I don't think, because I'm going to retire actually within the next year or so, that I'll have that same sort of relationship with them. So I think it's definitely different. You know, I'll go back 30 years versus now. It feels different.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Well, I want to end it there, again, reserving the right to possibly get back in touch and see if you'd like to do a little bit more.
Sure.
But I do like, if there's something that's sort of on your mind that you feel like you'd like to get on this one in case we do a follow-up and you aren't thinking about it. So do you have any sort of final thoughts or...
Well, I would say that I feel very lucky to be in Madison, Wisconsin. I feel very lucky to be at this university. I really feel I have a home here. I've had a great time. I've loved teaching here. I've really had no obstacles to teaching. I've been able to grow in, you know, that chosen career path as much as I want to. So, yeah, it's been a fantastic almost 40 years, actually.
Well, Kim, thank you for the time you gave me today. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. So this concludes the Oral History with Kim Lord Plummer. Okay, today is May 15th, 2020. This is a follow-up interview with Kim Lord Plummer. Since this interview is being done during the COVID-19 pandemic, this is a remote interview, meaning I'm in my home in Madison, Wisconsin. I'll let Kim say where she is when she introduces herself. This interview is being done for our Academic Staff Award Winners Oral History Project. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Archives. So, Kim, to help with sound quality, could you say your name, spell your last name, and you don't need to give the address, but maybe just a general location of where you are right now.
Okay, sure. Yep, my name is Kim Lord Plummer, last name LORDPLUMMER, two words. Yep, I'm here basically pretty close to campus area on the near west side of Madison, Wisconsin.
Great, thank you. So as we chatted before we turned on the recorder, I have a few questions, follow-up questions to ask. Mm-hmm. And the first follow-up question is kind of a two-parter. So were you involved in academic staff, governance, or campus groups? And if so, how?
I have not been involved in academic staff governance. With regard to groups, I'm not quite sure how that extends to various organizations on campus, but I guess I would say no in terms of university governance and that kind of thing. The answer would be no. I mean, I'm certainly involved in outreach and other things like that throughout the year. I don't know if that's the sort of thing that you're looking for, but.
Yeah, why don't, if you don't mind, maybe talking a little bit, so moving again sort of away from these specific academic staff governance or groups to some other outreach that you've been involved in on campus or are involved in on campus.
Sure. So I've been involved in outreach for several decades, and probably the highlight would be Grandparents University, which is offered through UW Extension and the Alumni Association. Put on every summer and invites grandparents and their grandchildren to participate in an interdisciplinary program. So this is something that's had a lot of meaning for me, not only because it allows me to do scientific outreach for any age group, but it brings grandparents and their grandchildren together to learn from each other. And that's something I find very valuable, especially in this day and age where people are often disconnected or virtually connected, and certainly that's absolutely the case these days with COVID. But bringing, you know, these different generations into the same room to learn from each other, I think that has tremendous value. So I've been involved in Grandparents University now. I organize it, set it up, conduct it, teach it, and I've been doing that for, oh gosh, probably close to 13 years now, I believe. And so that's one thing that I do. That does require a fair bit of my time. Because I use live animals in part of the teaching, obviously I do a vet med major. I don't know if you're familiar with Grand Prairie University as a campus program, but there are, I think now, somewhere around 21 or 22 majors. Veterinary medicine is one of those majors. And we are a very popular major because we do use live animals. So it's a two-day program. On the first day, we do a lot of activities centered around small animal veterinary medicine. On the second day, activities associated with large animal veterinary medicine. But because I use live animals, I have to have an animal protocol, and it just becomes a much more involved process than, you know, some of the majors which don't, you know, involve animals. So, So as a result of that, it is a fairly involved program from start to finish. So I usually start sometime in February, and the program is in July, and so just getting all the various aspects of the program together can take some time. But it is absolutely one of the most enjoyable things and one of the highlights of my year, especially when all these folks come from all over the country and sometimes outside the country, come back to the university and just start learning with their grandchildren, with their grandparents. It's a very inspirational activity to be involved in. So I love that. I'm also the faculty advisor for an outreach group club that the veterinary students began close to 10 years ago now, called VMU, Veterinary Medical Outreach Association. So I work with them to provide, expertise, materials for outreach. I'm involved in some of the activities that they do. I'm more there as, you know, a mentor and a guide than anything else. But we do get together, collaborate on a few outreach activities. So we'll do Science Saturday at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery. We do that a couple of times a year. We go into the local schools. We are involved in various kinds of club outreach activities, through the Madison area, through schools, through the Boys and Girls Club, after school programs, that kind of thing. So I've been working with the students, the veterinary medical students, on that for many, many years. And then I just do a variety of sort of miscellaneous outreach. I was involved in doing and I'm trying to rack my brains for the name of it right now. So it involved working a group on campus. I think it's a rotating program where they have the children of folks who serve in the military. And I'm trying to think of the name of the program, but it's evading me right now. And they bring these kids onto various university campuses, and as I say, I think it kind of rotates through various different universities across the country, bringing kids to campus for a day to explore some topic. So I've done that a few times. I work with the People Program as well, which I imagine you've heard of that. So we offer a veterinary medicine program for the People Program every summer. We do either middle school or high school or both. It kind of varies from year to year depending on the number of veterinary students who are interested in doing the program. So I've been working with that for many years as well, again providing anatomic specimens. I'll do a little teaching. Students will often ask me to do a day of, you know, heart anatomy or whatever the case may be. So those are the main things. And then just, as I say, some odd outreach things here and there that are kind of one-off sort of things. But the main things would be Grand Prairie University, VMU through the vet school, and the People Program. So, outreach is probably, one of the things that I feel most strongly about. I've always felt strongly about that. As a graduate student here on campus back in the 80s, in the neuroscience training program, I also worked with a student colleague at the time, and we got a grant through the Center for Biology Education, working with a woman named Dolly Ledeen, a grant to go into the Madison High Schools and develop modules for neuroscience education. So I've just always had an interest in kind of reaching out and, you know, being involved in getting the public at large, students in particular, young people in particular, excited about science in all its different forms. So.
Great. Thank you for that. My next question then, and I might follow up on that when we get to COVID. I might follow up on the grandparents you thing when we get to COVID.
Sure.
I now want to ask the question, you know, the reason why we're interviewing you, which is the Academic Staff Award that you won last year. So I have a few questions about that. And the first one is, did you know you were nominated?
I did know I was nominated, yes. My department chairman, Ted Golos, as well as our associate chair for education in our department, Steve Johnson, had nominated me the year before. And so, and I was involved in pulling together, actually, the materials for the nomination, as is, I think, often the case. So, but yes, I did know about it. Yep.
Okay. So then the next question is the thoughts or reactions when you heard that you had received an award.
Well, actually, to be perfectly honest, I was quite surprised. You know, as I'm sure you are aware, this is a world-class university, and certainly faculty are among some of the very best in the world in their areas of expertise, but so are the staff. I'm always really bowled over, just astounded at the level of excellence in the staff, you know, represented by the staff at this university. And, you know, I go to, you know, the teaching symposium every year and get involved in various, you know, let's see, what am I trying to say? Symposia and other meetings, in, you know, centered around teaching and best teaching practices and that kind of thing. So I've gotten to know, you know, a number of folks across campus over the years. And as I say, I'm stunned at the level of commitment to teaching, the fact that these people go above and beyond on a daily basis to create an exceptional learning environment, both for graduates and graduate students, professional students. It's really pretty remarkable. So to be singled out among people like that, I honestly was quite surprised. So I think there are so many deserving folks on this campus who do incredible things, you know, really creating new programs, new pedagogies, new way of teaching, you know, literally inventing materials to create an immersive learning experience, an authentic learning experience for students on this campus. I mean, it's just, there are hundreds of people who do this on a daily basis, and I think don't always get the credit they deserve. And I was fortunate enough to be asked, as a result of winning this award, to be asked to choose this year's winner in that category for teaching excellence. And again, just reading through the applications, or the nominations rather, I'm sorry, the nominations, once again reminded it just how superb, you know, these folks are, and the effort that they take, just because they know it's the right thing to do and they love what they do so much to make a world-class learning environment for students. So I guess that's a long way of saying I was pretty stunned, actually, because I work hard, I do my job, I do think that I go beyond my responsibilities. I love teaching students, I love working with students, but you know, I'm one of hundreds on campus that do that same thing every day. So yeah, I think pretty stunned that I was chosen. So yeah.
Thank you. So the last question about the award itself is your thoughts about the reception.
So as far as the sort of presentation of the award, is that what you mean?
That's what I mean.
Is that what you meant by, sure. It was lovely. It was very, very nice. I invited we were asked to provide them with a list of invitees for the reception. I invited my family, and I invited a number of people who have been my mentors over the years, many of whom, since I'm not that young, my mentors have all retired, so not many of them were able to be at the ceremony or at the reception. It meant a lot to me, actually, to just either, as a result of reaching out to them to be able to invite them to the ceremony, or have them actually come. It meant a lot to me to reconnect with people who've been instrumental in my formative, years through my career, because I had some outstanding mentors. And honestly, it chokes me up just thinking about them now, that how much I learned from them about not only about just the mechanics of teaching, but the passion that goes into teaching. All the different ways in which we can connect with students. What are the really powerful ways to connect with students? And I learned so much about that and about myself and about what teaching meant to me as a result of these mentors. So I think that was really the thing that stuck with me most about the reception. And then the other thing was just, again, getting to hear from these other award winners and just the dedication and excellence that they put into what they do on a daily basis. Again, it's very humbling. It's very, very humbling. So, but yeah, the reception was a lovely affirmation of, really a lifetime of work here on campus, and I really, really appreciated it, and I thought it was just a wonderful way to sort of round out that whole process. So, and very nice to meet Rebecca Blank and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you. So mm-hmm. I'd like to ask more about teaching now. Obviously, it's what you won the award for. It's what a lot of the discussion of the initial interview was, and rightfully so.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple of questions within this teaching section. And the first is, if you have or are able to articulate a philosophy towards teaching mm-hmm. that you have.
Sure. I think for me, the easiest way to sum it up is empowering students to believe in themselves. I don't know that teachers really teach, knowledge and concepts to students. It's really about creating, in my mind, it's really about creating a supportive and inclusive and safe environment in which people just let loose. They open up. They open up their minds to new ideas. And once you do that, you're just really creating, a place for people to learn. And then you just partner. You all partner together. I with them, them with me, and them with each other to learn. So that's really, I think, at the heart of my philosophy. And so in order to do that, you have to connect with people. So I think teaching is all about making connections. If people don't feel that they're in a place where they can make mistakes and say, often students will say, this is a dumb question. Well, that doesn't matter. It's just about getting the words out there, playing around with ideas. And if students don't feel they can be in a place where they can do that, make those mistakes, say what they need to say to work through a problem, then they're not going to learn. So it's not about me saying, okay, here's the content of the course. Here's what you need to know. Go and figure that out. I'm happy to answer questions. To me, that isn't really creating a learning environment. It's more about making those connections. So I've always tried very hard to get to know the students very, very well. So know each individual personally. So I always learn both first and last. I always learn where they come from. I always try to learn What makes them tick? Why did they come to vet school? What is their motivation? What do they hope to gain from this educational experience? The obvious things are true. Yeah, at the end, I'm going to get a DVM, but there's more to it than that. You know, where do you want to take this education? I try to get to know their educational background. That's really critical because I can't help them to find that safe place to learn unless I know where they're coming from to begin with. So I really try to get to know every student as an individual. And then I can start to play around with things at that point. I start to figure out, well, what is the best environment for this group or for this individual or for this small group of students, you know, depending on the circumstance or what, you know, the course or what I'm teaching. And I think that really helps to just open things up. It breaks down barriers and obstacles. And I think that's probably the thing that I've been most successful at. You know, I'm not the smartest person out there. I'm not, you know, there's nothing particularly special about me academically speaking. I mean, there's, you know, Madison, Wisconsin is comprised of thousands of PhDs. You know, it's just, I think it's more my willingness and my sort of relentless willingness to connect with students and make them feel that they are very safe with me and they can make as many mistakes as they need to, because I certainly have, and we all have as a way to learning, to come to know something. So I think that is at the heart of my teaching philosophy, empowering students to believe in themselves, creating that safe place to just let it all out and learn as much as they can and learn about themselves and learn to embrace lifelong learning. Because learning never stops. You know, as a professional student, that's something that, of course, they have to do. They have to do continuing education for the rest of their lives in order to be accredited to be licensed as physicians do. It's the same in veterinary medicine. So, I mean, it's something they certainly have to do, but it should be joyful. You know, the prospect of lifelong learning should be something that they are very, very excited about. So I think that's really at the heart of my philosophy, I would say.
Great. Thank you. So the mm-hmm. next question is how or if students have changed over time?
How or if students change over time?
Yep.
Oh gosh, that's a hard question to answer. You know, I think that I would like to say that at the heart of it, the students that I teach, veterinary medical students, have not fundamentally changed. I think that the students, and again, this is, I'm just so fortunate, so lucky to be able to work with these students. They haven't changed in the fact that they are very down-to-earth, honest, hardworking people generally. I think that's the kind of person that is drawn to veterinarian, because they know in the end they're not going to get rich. You know, this is a profession where you are going to give of yourself, and you know you're going to have to give of yourself for a lifetime, and you may not always get a lot back. Clients can be difficult to work with. Sometimes you don't get paid. You don't always get paid a lot for the amount of training and tuition that you've put into it. So these are folks who do it out of the sheer love of the profession. And so I think that element of these students hasn't changed. As learners, I think they have changed. So I feel like the newer generations of students require more explicit and structured, a more explicit and structured learning environment. Whereas 25, 30 years ago, I felt like the students seemed somewhat more independent. So as an example, maybe I'll just give you an example. 25 years ago, if I stood in front of the students and we talked about a topic and then went into the lab to explore that topic a little bit more, whether it's an anatomical principle or something like that, students would work very, very, very hard to try to solve a problem. So they would ask each other. They would talk about it openly. They would look in a textbook. This was maybe before we had access to online materials. They would try to figure out the answer to a problem. And when they couldn't, and they might work on it for days or weeks even, and when they couldn't, then they would come to me and they'd say, you know what, we've exhausted all the possibilities. We simply can't figure this thing out. Can you help us? And that, I think, was a very valuable learning experience for them, because that's what we all have to do all the time. But it showed me that they really tried hard to work through the problem themselves before just trying getting that sort of instant gratification. What I find now with students is a question pops into their head, and instead of thinking about it or working with their peers, maybe trying to find the answer, whether it's online or in a textbook or whatever, trying to seek maybe a research paper or whatever the case may be, they will instantly ask for the answer. You know, and so that is a change I've noticed. That's a very distinct change. You know, ask about it before you've really had a moment to step back and just think, well, maybe I can figure this out, you know, with a little bit of thought, a little bit of effort. So I think that has changed. And that's not true of all students, but I think it's more true of more students than it used to be. Having a lot of access to material. You know, back in the old days, we gave them a hard copy set of notes at the beginning of the semester and said, you know, here you go. This is your material. Seek any resources that you'd like to. Please feel free to ask us if you need any other resources. We'll certainly help you find stuff if that's necessary. But it was that kind of that hard copy packet of notes that that they used. Now, of course, because of Canvas, and I think we touched on this. I do recall now touching on this last time. I think because of the learning management systems and the ability to have a lot of resources available to them remotely, they want more and more and more. And so that has, I think, become, at least for me, a little more difficult to manage. I feel like I'm constantly checking on the resources for students, uploading resources for students, or responding to students saying, I can't find that resource, and you have to get back and say, it's right there. You know, in week 14, you know, the Heinlein module, whatever, that kind of thing, that sort of back and forth about just all these resources. And, you know, one of the things that I do try to do as course director in the beginning of the year is, again, empower students to, you know, first of all, seek out their own resources if they want them, but to take charge of the sort of the learning management site. Check on it frequently. Go, you know, get to know it well. Here's how we're going to structure it. Get in there, you know, set aside a time every Friday at noon or whatever it may be to go through the material, see what's there. You know, you can do this. You don't need us to sort of handhold you through where all of these resources are, what's important, not important, and so on. It's up to you to figure out what is important. It's up to you to sift and winnow and decide how to prioritize, you know, this information that is available to you. So I think that is the thing for me that's changed the most, is having to do a little bit more handhold, I think, being a little bit more explicit about, yes, I'll get an email from a student. I'll have put a document on Canvas. And they'll say, is this document important? And well, yeah, that's why I put it on Canvas, you know. So getting those kinds of questions, which I never, ever, ever got before. You know, if we gave students materials, I think they made the assumption that those materials were important, you know, and it was their responsibility to work through them. But now there's just a lot more, do I need this? Do I need that? Should I ignore this? You know, all of those sorts of things rather than, you know, just sort of working through it a little bit more on their own. Now, the other side of that coin is that there's so much more information than there ever was before, you know, with the learning management systems, with all the resources that they can access online. I think there is a tendency for them to feel overwhelmed. So I do have sympathy for that. I certainly feel overwhelmed myself, you know, with all the materials that are out there. But one of the lessons that I do try to impart is that it's up to you to be critical of all this material. You know, what is the best material for you to learn in this course? And so part of that is, you know, them figuring out how to sift and winnow, what rises to the top. So I think those are the main things. I think at the core, the character of these students hasn't changed. They are absolutely wonderful people, you know, almost across the board, 100%. I'm really awed and inspired by these students on a daily basis. It's really a privilege to be able to work with them. That hasn't changed. But the way they learn, the way they gather information, their expectations for how you structure their learning environment, I think, has changed.
Okay. Thank you. So,
yeah.
The last question, I think you've touched on sort of indirectly in ways, but I want to ask it directly, and that's, what, if anything, have they taught you?
Let's see. I think that probably the thing I have learned the most from veterinary students is selflessness. These students, you know, as I alluded to, you know, they are going into this profession with the right mindset, with their hearts in the right place. These are people who have spent their lifetime as young people. You know, many of them have done more than I have in a whole lifetime, to be honest, that have spent their lifetime giving, absolutely giving, not only to make, conditions for animals in various types of circumstances, whether it's working at a humane society, working at a shelter, working at a neuter spay clinic, whatever the case may be, shadowing in a veterinary clinic. They have spent their lives giving. And, you know, it would be easy to be sort of jaded and say, well, they're doing all these things to get into veterinary school. But in fact, they really aren't. These are people who have spent, you know, they've done it all. Whether they've given up their time to work at a riding stable, to work with kids who have autism, to, you know, training companion animals for folks who may need them, whether it's as a result of a physical disability or a mental health disability, to, as I say, you know, spending years, literally their young years, working in, you know, a shelter, slogging through stuff, cleaning up, doing whatever they need to do to really help. There are people who go all over the world to help other communities, help other populations, people who would not otherwise have access to veterinary medical care. Whether it's, you know, in their agricultural pursuits, you know, raising animals for food or just their companion animals. It's pretty remarkable. So I honestly think that's the thing that I've learned most about these people, is that giving and being selfless really is a noble pursuit. I think that's it. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for that. So mm-hmm. We're now moving to a section that didn't exist when we first met. I guess it existed, but not in the extent it currently exists, and that's the COVID-19 pandemic that we're all living through, not just here in Wisconsin,
sure,
but the country and world. So I wonder if, to just give you some space, and this is totally open-ended, just allow you to touch on some thoughts that you have about how it's affected your work and how it's affected your life.
Sure, sure. I mean, this is certainly a hard one to put into a few words. You know, honestly, I think that the first thing that pops into my mind, and again, I don't know where anybody's sort of political affiliations are, and I certainly don't mean to be step on any toes or anything like that, but I do feel quite a bit of distress at the incompetence of the federal government. You know, that's something that as a family we talk about quite a lot. I feel sadness for, you know, the many people who have died as a result of, you know, this pandemic, but also as a result of our failure to respond in a timely way. I think that if our federal government had been more proactive, had listened to the advice of experts that was clearly available for in this country back in January, and had acted upon the science much earlier, you know, and again, this kind of brings me back to science outreach. I feel very, very strongly about science literacy, and that's why I do what I do. And I think that when we have people in our leadership who aren't scientifically literate, this is the very kind of thing that can happen. But anyway, you know, I think if they had acted on that scientific information earlier on, that, you know, it's impossible to say exactly what the outcome would be, but most people agree we would have been in a better position right now, and hopefully getting back to something resembling normalcy a little bit faster. So, I feel a lot of distress and sadness with regard to that, and I'm certainly not the only one. It is unfortunate. It's just it's hard to put into words, you know. I think it didn't have to be this way. And unfortunately, we have a government who puts economy and capitalism ahead of people, and that's not something that, you know, that doesn't sit well with me. So, let's see, what else? As far as teaching is concerned, well, I've learned all kinds of new things. I can't even enumerate them. Oh, my goodness. So Blackboard, Collaborate Ultra as one example. So we had to leave the vet school because the first case on campus happened to be, as far as I know, and I think this is the case, was at the vet school. So on the 13th of March, we got an email at about 3:20 in the afternoon that said, pack up and go home. Take what you need, and you'll be home indefinitely. And, of course, at that point, we didn't know that, you know, it was going to mean the rest of the semester. We really didn't know anything at that point. Then by the next week, which for us at the vet school, the next week, the following week, was our spring break. It doesn't coincide with campus, so that was our spring break. And early on in the week, we learned that, you know, this is going to be indefinite. And so, you know, hunker down, stay at home, students aren't coming back. And so we had a week to figure out how to deliver instruction remotely for really 100% strictly hands-on courses. So I teach in spring, I teach a large animal anatomy course. We spend 95% of our time in the laboratory with cadavers, horse cadavers and ox cadavers. And that's how we learn. And so it was, so there was that whole part. I think that whole side of things was just learning, you know, how can we tap into a whole variety of resources? How can we learn new technology, you know, within a week's time to at least try to continue to deliver, you know, instruction to the student. Now, fortunately for us, with regard to anatomy, the students had already had almost a full year of anatomy. So they at least had somewhat of a foundation. So it was really just finishing up that final third of our large animal anatomy course. So we could really build off a lot of stuff that we already had. But nonetheless, you know, it was searching for resources, spending time communicating with the libraries to see what textbooks are available digitally. And as it happens for anatomy, none were available digitally. So that, you know, that became kind of a dead end. But again, that took a week of kind of going back and forth to figure out, you know, what might be available to students. as I say, learning all of these conferencing technologies. You know, we started out with WebEx, and that really was awful. And then we went to Microsoft Teams as far as, you know, faculty and staff meeting with each other, and then learned Blackboard Ultra. Took a while to get up to speed on that, but it ended up being really a valuable learning experience, I think, because in one of the other courses I teach in spring, the neuroscience course, I do a lot of problem-based learning, case studies. And at the vet school, we've recently, in the last few years, built a learn facility where students can work collaboratively in small groups. So I've capitalized on that learning space by doing these case studies, neurologic case studies with the students. So I form 16 groups of 6 students, and they work collaboratively to solve this neurologic problem. Well, of course, we couldn't do that together, but we learned how to do it using Blackboard Ultra, and it actually worked reasonably well. You know, a few glitches here and there. Connectivity issues, of course, were pretty rampant. But all in all, I think it was very valuable to be exposed to that and learn how to do that, because I think that could be of value in the future, whether we can meet in person or not. Let's see, what else? Learning how to create exams using Canvas quiz tools. That was a huge, huge learning curve. But again, I think really valuable in the end. We learned a lot about what we can't do, and we learned a lot about what we can do. And trying to give a large anatomy exam with a Canvas quiz is not good. It really is not optimal, both for us setting it up and for the students taking it. It really is meant to be for a short, formative type of exam. So then, you know, maybe we contact, you know, folks on campus, whether it's through DOIT, the instructional technology group there, to say, hey, can we, you know, write some software that can manage much larger exams with a lot of images and that kind of thing. You know, those are ideas I wouldn't have known about to even ask about before, but that's something we could certainly look into. So I think those are the main things. You know, it's just learning the technology, learning with regard to education and COVID, learning what can be of value, you know, at normal times when we're doing person-to-person teaching as well. Communication, I think, actually there is one word. Communication, I think, was something that I found difficult. With students, communication with students. So, you know, I have an open door policy at work with my office, and I have students coming to my office all the time. And that's something I have encouraged, I've engendered, I've fostered over the years, you know, just as a sort of, as a part of my teaching philosophy. I keep my door open so students can ask any kinds of questions anytime. And, you know, striving to make it a safe place for students to come and feel supported. So that's something I really missed a lot, is not being able to physically connect with students. So I met with students a lot on Blackboard because they can do that through Canvas, so it wasn't necessary for us to meet with students in Microsoft Teams or anything like that. We could do it through Blackboard. And while that was good, it's just not the same. So I did miss that element. And then being able to get kind of that biofeedback, you know, when you're having a face-to-face conversation with someone, it's, for me anyway, it's so much easier to sort of read the room, to get an understanding of what they're asking, what they need. I found that more difficult to do remotely. I wasn't very comfortable with that whole side of things. And then students had a ton of questions, of course, and they would email. And we tried to set up discussion boards, or rather we did set up discussion boards on Canvas, but they tended not to use those. And I wonder if maybe they felt like, you know, I don't really want my question broadcast. I'd rather just ask Dr. Plummer and we can have our private conversation, you know. So working out the best ways to be able to communicate remotely with students when they feel they don't necessarily want to broadcast to everybody else. So I found that awkward sometimes, and it was a lot of work because I'd get maybe 30 questions a day from students, and I'd have to answer everyone individually. And then I'd say, do you mind if I put it on the discussion board? And someone would say yes, and someone would say no, you know, and then I'd have to transfer it to the discussion board. So it was just a lot of busy work around trying to communicate with people. And I felt like that wasn't always the best use, you know, of anybody's time. It's just all the sort of technical side of communication. Let's see. I think those are the main things, I think, with regard to COVID. Obviously, the more global aspect of this, local, you know, statewide, nationwide, global aspect of the COVID, I think, you know, is, as I say, it's beyond description, I think, in many ways. Mm-hmm. But in terms of teaching, I think there have been definitely some positives. A few negatives, for sure. We know that the students, because our veterinary students really value community and community of practice, they thrive with their class and learning from each other. And again, that's something I tried to foster. And I think being apart from each other was very, very difficult on them, as it was on everyone. But in terms of their ability to learn effectively and efficiently, I think that really took a toll on them. I think there were some good things that we've learned about how to teach in the event of all different kinds of circumstances. And we can certainly use those technologies and those strategies into the future. But the other thing we've learned is that I think as a community, we really like to be together. We like an immersive experience, and we enjoy that sort of face-to-face, conversation, whether it's formal or informal, that we, you know, foster on a daily basis at the school. So. Mm.
Great.
So good things and some not so good things.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Great. Well, thank you for that. So we got a couple mm-hmm. more minutes left. So let's move to the final question, which is kind of a two-parter, and that's legacy. You're still teaching, obviously. Mm-hmm. You haven't retired, but I always like
not
to ask.
Yet,
yeah. I always like to ask about legacy, and it's, as I said, it's a two-part. Like, what do you feel you'll be remembered for, and is it what you want to be remembered for?
Sure. Let's see. I think that I will be remembered for someone, you know, and again, not alone in this, because I'm surrounded by unbelievably outstanding colleagues, but I think that one of the things I'll be remembered for is that I put students first. With regard to teaching, I worked, you know, my tail off all the time to improve the learning experience for students. So, you know, whether it was on a weekly basis or, a semester basis or a yearly basis, you know, I would take a look at the courses because I've directed three courses. So I've been in a leadership role of three of our fundamental courses for the first-year curriculum. Off and on or continuously for many, many years. So, and I've never just sort of sat back and said, you know, yep, the course is running well, we get good evaluations, we're good, let's just sit on it. You know, I've just never felt comfortable with that. I'm always looking for ways to improve the experience for the students, whether that means updating it to be more relevant with regard to the world, with regard to veterinary medicine, with regard to new science, with regard to technology, and with regard to our learners. So that's part of the reason I like to stay fluent in what's known about our current learners so that I can tailor the courses to reach as many people and be, I guess, accessible to as many people as possible. So I think that's the main thing, is that you know, I've really striven to improve and continue to improve the learning experience for students. I think that would be, you know, and just worked hard to do that. I think also, you know, being a person who's always been very supportive of our community, been a cheerleader for veterinary medicine and what these veterinary professionals do, because a lot of people don't know the level of education that they get, the amount of work they put into it, and just the amount of giving that they do to make the world a better place. So I've always been a cheerleader for that, and I think I'll be remembered for that as well. Sorry, what was the second part? Is that what I want? That is exactly what I like to be remembered for. So, you know, those are the things that mean the most to me. So, you know, to be remembered for the things that you're most passionate about, I think is, a win-win. So.
Great. We have just a couple more minutes. Is there any other final thoughts you'd like to express before we close this oral history?
I think I have touched on most of the things that I feel very strongly about. I guess I would just say that, I do hope to retire fairly soon. I'm getting to that stage of my life. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons I want to retire is because, you know, there's many reasons. Part of it is just that time of life. But in veterinary medicine, one of the things, so in this profession, there is the highest suicide rate of any other profession at this point in time. And there are many, many reasons for that, and I don't need to go into that. But one of the things that we have begun to work very, very hard on in this profession is wellness. Personal wellness, physical wellness, mental health wellness, and just, you know, striving to lead a balanced life. And one of the things that I have done for many, many years is I've worked very, very hard for a number of reasons I won't go into, both professional reasons and personal reasons. And I've worked very, very hard, really at the expense of sometimes my own physical and mental health. So, you know, I think that part of the reason that I do want to retire is to just get back to sort of centering myself, getting back to having a more balanced life, you know, spending more time with my family and my husband, who is retired. He's been retired for a few years, and I have two wonderful young dogs and spending more time with them and doing other things. But the other thing I would like to do is, once I do retire, is I'd like to find a way to give back to the, you know, the veterinary medical profession. And whether that, you know, I have no idea what that's going to look like at this point. But, you know, whether that means, you know, volunteering at, you know, a shelter, or going back into the school to help teach a little bit, you know, to offload some of the burden of our other faculty and staff. Whether that means maybe doing some tutoring for students, or working with younger people to prepare them for maybe a potential career in veterinary medicine. You know, as I say, I have no idea what that looks like. But the veterinary medical profession, and I am not a veterinarian, I'm a PhD, I'm a basic scientist, but it has left such a huge impression. You know, the people in this profession have left such a huge impression on me that, you know, I feel like, even though I'd like to retire, as I say, to kind of get that balance back in my life, I do want to continue to be involved with the profession for many years to come in some capacity. So I guess I would say that, you know, it's, I love what I do. I think I have derived much more from the people that I've worked with, the students that I've taught, my colleagues, than I've ever given to them, and so I feel very, very fortunate for that. So it's been a wonderful life.
Great.
I guess I would end on that.
Great. So, Kim, I want to chat with you just briefly after we end this recording, but I'm now going to officially conclude. So this concludes the oral history interview with Kim Lord Plummer. Kim, thank you for the time you gave me back in February and then the time you gave me today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.